Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. This podcast is the fifth in a series on the theme, Who Am I? And what I've done so far with these podcasts is to outline various approaches to the question, Who Am I? This episode deals with what I've called the phenomenological approaches. Now, phenomenology is a nice word. It's been around for some time. There is a 20th century school in Western philosophy called phenomenology, funny enough. And this is the work of Edmund Husserl and offshoots from that work. Husserl was alive back end of the 19th century. And into the 20th century. I think he died in 1938. He was a Jew and he was persecuted by the Nazis. And interestingly also, not treated very well by his own student, one Martin Heidegger, who was to become a big wheel in 20th century philosophy. There's a couple of branches of phenomenology. Just roughly speaking, there's the classic form is laid out by Husserl in his early work. And there's existential phenomenology, whereby the disciplines have been put to work, perhaps across a wider sphere, and across the sphere of what we would call life world, or the life world. That's just the world of human experience in all of its aspects. Including its cultural aspects, political aspects, psychological aspects, and so on. Phenomenology has also had quite an impact on psychiatry and psychotherapy and psychology. It's a very broad church. I'm not an expert enough in it to give you a thorough account of all the various nuances and so on. But what I'm taking from that approach here is Husserl's adage that philosophical inquiry to move forward needs to concern itself with the things themselves. And by this he means our experience, our lived experience. The fluctuations of consciousness, you might say. And the point here is to, in order to get a fresh look at the workings of consciousness, we need to bracket out, for the time being, our natural attitude. And this is called epoche, or bracketing. And this is all the stuff we take for granted in our daily workings. To do phenomenology, you put them aside, so you're getting this kind of fresh look. This is not to say that one abandons the natural attitude. You couldn't. It keeps us going. It works for us in a very important and necessary way. So this is not abandoning natural attitude. This is bracketing natural attitude in order to perform a particular type of inquiry, and an inquiry into consciousness. Now, I find like great resonances here with what's going on in the early part of the Yoga Sutra, maybe the first half a dozen aphorisms. We are, in a sense, in those first aphorisms, being invited into a kind of epoche, to a kind of bracketing. Because basically, Patanjali is saying there that yoga as a desirable, blessed and incredibly useful being state and an ineffable being state lies apart from, in some sense, the noisy monologue of our lived experience of mentation itself, of whirlpools in the mind. In other words, any kind of repetitious patterns of thought, feeling and behaviour. It was called vrittis or whirlpools. Naturally, our natural attitude, all the stuff we take for granted in order to function, is a collection of vrittis, a collection of whirlpools in the mind. And Patanjali is saying that there is a cognition available to us. You understand that samadhi, as well as being a bliss, is also a cognition. One knows something as a result of having experienced it. And Patanjali is saying that for samadhi, we need to let the brain settle, the mind settle, the vrittis need to be allowed to sink into the background. Now, this is a process that can occur, because it seems to me it's kind of quite natural in some ways. As much as the brain needs and likes to think, and as much as our life demands thought of us, at the same time, our life demands quiet of us. It demands stepping back of us. Also. So, Patanjali, I would say, is recommending something very close to the epoche, in as much as there is a definite practice, a sitting meditation, which is not terribly technical, but nevertheless, which does entail the yoga being state, coming to the fore, and the vrittis, the noisy, repetitious, functional stuff, going to the background. Now, this doesn't mean, as some people really disastrously and mistakenly think, that Patanjali is against the natural attitude and believes it should be excised and crushed. He doesn't. If you actually read a bit further on in the Yoga Sutra, when he talks about types of vrittis, you realise that vrittis are essential to human life, as well as being a kind of obstacle to a new knowledge, a new cognition. I mean, this is plain to see when Patanjali mentions, for instance, memory as one of the vrittis, and the ability to perform rational inferences through deduction and induction and so forth. So, it's not vrittis per se which are being vilified in Patanjali, as I said, as some people think, at all. It's just that Patanjali points out that we can step back from the everyday and that this is definitely worth doing, especially if we want to know some stuff, if we want the cognition of samadhi. Now, well, what is this cognition of samadhi? What is cognitive about samadhi? Samadhi is actually a deep relaxation of all the boundaries that are produced by the interpretative activity of the mind, of the vritti producing activity of the mind. I mean, just putting it bluntly, samadhi is a melting away of boundaries, particularly the primordial boundary of subject and object. So the sense that one feels oneself to be an entity which is observing some grass and some fallen leaves and some sky, where that something is a subject, distinct, discrete, with its own boundary, over and against objects, or the object, in my case here I'm walking along, the world. samadhi, in as much as it is the dawning of the silence of the yoga being state emerging in the foreground, obviously plainly contradicts the natural attitude which says, well, I am an ego. I am my name. I am that psychoanalytic clump of recorded experiences. So what does this say about who am I? And I would say that the cognition of samadhi, though it's not a cognition we can state in a list of propositions, it is actually a feeling of such ease that the brain thinks it knows everything. But one thing we can say, one danger, I think, of utterance around the ineffable, which I think we can venture, is to say that who am I starts to feel like nobody. There's nobody there. There's nothing. There's not a boundary which we can give the name I. There isn't one. Or if there is one, it's kind of flimsy and it's kind of arbitrary and it's kind of shifting. And similarly, the world of objects isn't a world of objects. Discrete objects, but a world of flux, of pattern, of movement. So self and world become this one thing, self-world, which is movement or dance. Now I am here actually letting samadhi do what it's supposed to do in terms of language, which is to poeticise. Again, this is something that's kind of forgotten largely by the yoga community, if I can call it that. And it is the fact that the yoga being state and the beatitude of yoga is in itself intensely creative. It's a kind of wellspring. It's a kind of a bubbling up of, oh, you might say art, I suppose, art, cognition, philosophy, but in the poetic form, its main mode is, especially when it interacts with language, is poetry. When it interacts with the body, it's movement, it's dance, it's rhapsodic dance. So I'd use it, call Patanjali's approach in that first part of the Yoga Sutra, his phenomenology. Sometimes call it Patanjali's Zen, actually, because of the directness of it and the absence of ornamentation, which of course is a feature of Zen. It loves this spare aesthetic, and Patanjali shares it in that early part of the Yoga Sutra. And it's very direct. You know, we just look, but we look with an epoche, and that epoche actually is we look with as much clarity as we can muster, with our eyes clear, accepting what's going on, rather than trying to reject or accept or love or hate what's going on. Rather than busily trying to categorise what's going on, we just are open and sensitive to it. And if one is quiet, if one allows oneself to settle down, that sensitivity just automatically comes about. Because it's no good looking with plasters over your eyes. You have to look with your eyes clear, yeah, metaphorically speaking. And remember the field of this exploration is our field of awareness itself, our consciousness itself. So this almost non-method method, this phenomenological method that Patanjali gives us, is to allow a sensitivity to emerge, and with the sensitivity of the metaphorical eye, EYE, to investigate, just to take a look, to go in and just look, playing, receptive, taking it in. So that is the style of inquiries, and you can see it's not a busy inquiry. We're not busy manipulating aspects of our psyche, trying to change them, trying to mould them, trying to bring them into different relationships with each other, as you might in quite a wide range of spiritual exercises, you might call them, and also psychotherapeutic exercises, and also if you get involved in one of these self-help games that which kind of make big dollars in the modern world, self-improvement, self-help. It's not that. It's almost the opposite of that. We're just seeking to see. And to see who we are and what we are. So that's the phenomenological take, and its core thing there is kind of letting be. But with bright awareness. We let be when we go to bed and sleep. We let be, but we're not aware, so we don't learn anything, except perhaps we might have a dream that might have some symbolic clues for us. But basically, the letting be needs to be accompanied by a bright awareness. Not difficult, quite straightforward. But you need a lot of patience. Well, you need so much patience that it's no longer patience, to be honest. Because what you need to be doing there is just allowing a natural settling to take place and to encounter. What's going on in all its glory? The next episode in this series on the question, who am I? We'll deal with language, we'll take a kind of linguistic approach. And I think it's quite a nice one. Okie doke. Over and out.